B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Monday, May 20th, 2019. A Republican has stepped forward and, in a carefully worded tweet, said that after reading the Mueller report, he believes that Donald Trump has engaged in impeachable conduct. Now, this is significant in some ways. Justin Amash is a libertarian who runs as a Republican, and he often steps out of line from Republican orthodoxy. And to his credit, he has opposed domestic surveillance. He has opposed America's wartime adventures and regime change operations. And so he does stand out as different from many Republicans. And while he often, you know, votes with the party line on issues that I find pretty stinky, Justin Amash deserves credit when he does stand up for, well, honorable things. So on Saturday, after he says he completed reading the Mueller investigation report, and he said that he believes many of his congressional colleagues have not yet done so, he issued a series of tweets, one where he said that Attorney General Bill Barr misled the American public in the spinned-up so-called summary of the Mueller investigation that was allowed to linger and poison the air for almost 3 weeks before the redacted version of the Mueller report was made public. So I give him a lot of credit. He says, while impeachment should be undertaken only in extraordinary circumstances, the risk we face in an environment of extreme partisanship is not that Congress will employ it as a remedy too often, but rather that Congress will employ it so rarely that it cannot deter misconduct. Now, will this lead to a sea change? Will other Republicans find cover behind Justin Amash? I doubt it. Trump is already tweet-trashing him, saying that he's a loser, he's never been a fan, he's a total lightweight, he opposes me and some of our great Republican ideas and policies just for the sake of getting his name out there through controversy. Now, that last part's not fair. Neither is the first part, really, but I don't think that Justin Amash seeks controversy. I think he actually has a moral core, and that makes him different from most of his Republican colleagues. But it also stands in some stark relief to the Democrats who are dancing around, demanding indignantly that Trump releases tax returns, that Mueller's got to testify, that former White House counsel Don McGahn has got to testify. But as long as they refuse to set up an impeachment process, Trump is there defiantly saying, I don't care about your subpoenas. I don't care about the separation of powers or congressional oversight obligations. What are you going to do? Impeach me? And so far, he knows the answer to that question. And like a petulant, out-of-control teenager, he will continue defiance, obstruction, and stonewalling until the Democrats face the reality that, yes, impeachment might be politically costly. But I don't believe there is any other choice. And as you know, I don't believe the first part of the Mueller report about the sweeping interference in our election by Russian operatives. But I do believe the second part of the Mueller report about obstruction of justice. And even Justin Amash, a Republican, cannot deny it or ignore it. And so the Democrats, I think, are squandering valuable time and energy, allowing Trump to continue to dodge, to lie, and to buffalo the Democrats through his various stonewalling efforts. And here's an interesting tidbit. I want to note the source, and I've linked to it in the show file for today's podcast. It is the blog Moon of Alabama. And I've never met this guy. I once read his name. I believe he lives in an Eastern European country. But he's a dead-on commentator about American politics. And he picked up this little tidbit. Last week, Mike Pompeo, who plays Secretary of State in the Trump reality TV show, made his first visit to Russia. Now, I'm surprised that this is his first official visit, but that's what it says. And he went to Sochi, you know, the town where they held the Olympics a few years back. And he met with the foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, and with Putin. And Putin made him wait 3 hours sitting in the reception room before he actually received him. But here's what is interesting. Lavrov said that in 2016, there was a special channel, an information exchange channel set up about potential unintended risks arising in cyberspace starting back in 2013. So this was during the Obama administration, and kind of like the red phone that was supposed to prevent a nuclear war, this was a channel, not a back channel, but it was set up to enable dialogue. And Lavrov has proposed publishing the exchange of messages between these two entities, which engage in, quote, staving off cyberspace incidents. And at a news conference, he publicly said, I reminded Pompeo about this today. The administration, now led by Trump, refused to do so. I'm not sure who was behind this decision, but the idea to publish this data was blocked by the United States. We believe that publishing it would remove many currently circulating fabrications. Of course, we will not unilaterally make these exchanges public. I don't know why, but that was his position. And so Moon of Alabama writes, one inference from Lavrov's statement is that the fundamental understanding on this matter between the two presidents has not fully been implemented, and that would be the release of the communications about cyberspace incidents. The Russians clearly think that a release of the communications with the Obama administration would exculpate them. That would also exculpate Trump from any further collusion allegations. Why then does the Trump administration reject the release? Who is blocking it? Later in his blog post, Moon of Alabama writes, there were secret communications between the Obama administration and the Russian government about the alleged election interference and hacks of the DNC and of Clinton's campaign manager, Podesta. And correctly, the word hacks there is embraced by quotation marks. He goes on, they're not mentioned in the Mueller report, nor in any other open space. And he goes on to say, the allegations of Russian interference, based on, in part, on the fact that a commercial Russian enterprise used fake characters on Facebook to sell advertisements, that's the work of the Troll Farm in St. Petersburg, the Internet Research Agency. He says, a review of the themes and ideological positions those fake characters provided demonstrates they were not designed to influence the U.S. elections. But in contrast, well, on Friday, Facebook banned a bunch of pages controlled by an Israeli company. Actually, it was Thursday, my mistake. Facebook said it banned an Israeli company that ran an influence campaign aimed at disrupting elections in various countries and has canceled dozens of accounts engaged in spreading disinformation. They were linked to the Archimedes Group, a Tel Aviv-based political consulting and lobbying firm that boasts of its social media skills and ability to change reality. Now, this kind of parallels what's been coming out of Bill Barr's mouth, that he wants to investigate the origins of the Russiagate investigation. And I know this sends a lot of Democrats screaming and just, you know, hypocritically and dramatically saying that, you know, we believe the FBI, we love the FBI. How could they attack the FBI? And I don't know where this will lead. I don't know if we will get honest results or just partisan spin. But I believe that investigation is going to go forward, and it's going to be real interesting. So my neck's a little bit sore because I've gotten whiplash from reading news accounts and particularly just headlines about the U.S. posture toward Iran. So last week, after Bolton and Pompeo made these threats, and the week before we claimed we were sending the aircraft carrier group Lincoln to the Persian Gulf, even though it was already on its way there, and that was debunked by British intelligence, who said, you know, this claim that there was new intelligence that's scary, that's deeply exaggerated. So let's just look at some headlines here. I'm using primarily the New York Times. Friday, President insists he doesn't want a war with Iran. Message to Pentagon. Effort to defuse tensions. Pompeo is asking for overseas help. Now, this is so laughable. We have isolated ourselves by breaching the multi-country nuclear deal with Iran. And now we're asking other countries to help us. Get Iran to moderate its behavior. But we are the provocateurs here. And so that appears to be lost on the corporate media. But also on Friday, headline, U.S. war on Iran, weary Middle East rolls its eyes and wrings its hands. And so we get this back and forth, where at one minute we are teetering on the brink of a war with Iran, and now we look at Saturday's New York Times. Iran signals relaxation of tensions, officials say, and they're telling us that those missiles that have been installed in these small fishing boats called dhows have been removed, and that we can relax, take our missiles off red alert. And then we turn later. This is another article in Saturday's New York Times. Attacks on Saudi oil infrastructure show high risk of conflict with Iran. And we know the Saudis would like the U.S. to attack Iran. We know the Israelis would like the U.S. to attack Iran. But in Saturday's paper, we also get this schizophrenic comment. Israel presses the case against Tehran, but for tougher diplomacy, not a strike. Now, this does appear to be news because Netanyahu has been pounding the war drums, trying to urge the United States to attack Iran for several years now. And so suddenly, he's being a good cop here, saying, oh, we want tougher diplomacy, you know, we want to negotiate a new deal. All right, then we get to Sunday. And there is a report that a missile was launched into the green zone in Baghdad, in Iraq, near the statue of the unknown soldier. And get this, it's described as less than a mile from the U.S. embassy. Less than a mile. So, was the embassy the target? This news report doesn't tell us. But we know that John Bolton has set a red line that any attack on any American facility anywhere by Iran, or that something that can be blamed on Iran, could be the basis for U.S. military action against Iran. So, then we go to Twitter. And after this, incident in Baghdad, Trump went on to Twitter, warned Iran not to threaten the U.S. or else it would face its official end. Those are the moderate words of our president who doesn't want war with Iran. And Javad Zarif, the foreign minister of Iran, tweeted back with contempt, goaded by the B-team, referring to Bolton, Trump hopes to achieve what Alexander, Genghis, and other aggressors failed to do. Iranians have stood tall for millennia, while aggressors all gone. Economic terrorism and genocidal taunts won't end Iran. And then he added with the hashtag, never threaten an Iranian. Try respect. It works. Then to Monday's paper and an AP dispatch in my San Francisco Chronicle, Saudis disavow seeking war as tensions fester. And last week, errant U.S. bombers killed 17 Afghan forces who were on our side, and there was also a bombing raid supported by the U.S. but led by Saudi Arabia that killed a dozen people at a wedding in Yemen. There is also this a report that the Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen tried to launch a single missile toward Mecca. And I've only heard sketchy reports on this so far, so I don't know if that's going to become a thread for continued bellicose commentary and threats against Iran. My belief is that Iran has a very narrow role in Yemen and that it is hugely exaggerated in corporate media here in the U.S. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the PBC podcast with your subscriptions. People like Joey Perillo, the great actor in Philly, Paul Tomaselli, the indefatigable, I think I said that right, Faith Peoples, and who else here? Ethan Knox sends me $5 a month. And I appreciate each and every one of you. It's the validation I need. It helps pay the bills. And someday I might actually make a living doing this if we get enough subscribers. So join in. Just visit peterbcollins.com, click menu, click become a subscriber. You're on the sign-up page, and you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month. Our $50 annual subscription earns you our bonus book. You have a choice of 2100, A Dystopian Utopia, the blueprint for human survival due to climate change. And also, I've got at least one, maybe two copies of Dr. Justin Frank's profile of Donald Trump called Trump on the Couch. They are available as bonus books for new annual subscribers. So take out a subscription today, and I'd be happy to get a book in the mail to you shortly. I've been having a hard time with yellow journalism from the New York Times. I was away last week, didn't get to comment on the Sunday story a week ago, where the New York Times flatly declared that 5G wireless is safe, but that the Russian network RT is dividing Americans by propagandizing us that 5G hasn't been tested. We don't know the health impacts. And it's being used to bulldoze local control over the placement of these towers. And I just found that so deeply offensive. I'm one of millions of Americans who have serious questions about the safety of 5G because it's never been tested. And I deeply object to the use of 5G to eviscerate local regulation of where these cell antennas can be placed and the effects that they can lead to. So that's item one of yellow journalism by the New York Times. Item two was in this past Saturday's paper. There were two yellow journalism stories side by side. The first, Venezuela's fall like a civil war. A once robust economy has become a ruin. And this is such a slanted and negative story. Now, I do not for a moment dispute that there is real hardship being borne by people in Venezuela today. But this article blames it entirely on Maduro and Chavez and socialism. It makes a passing reference to how U.S. sanctions have made things worse. They never discuss the dramatic drop in the price of crude oil that led to the strangulation of the Venezuelan economy. And there is zero mention of the effort to take down the Chavez government in the failed coup back in 2002. They have plenty of room in this story if they wanted to cover it with accuracy and full context, but they chose not to. And the third yellow journalism story that was parked right next to that Venezuela story on Saturday's front page is an attack on Bernie Sanders because as mayor of Burlington, Vermont, he had a foreign policy. And he opposed Reagan's regime change wars in Central America, particularly in Nicaragua. He traveled there. He advocated for the Sandinistas. And the New York Times assigned a reporter who I can only presume is very young and didn't live through that period. The reporter's name is Sydney Ember. And Sydney asks a bunch of loaded questions and writes in a way that basically says that because Sanders was not gaining traction on local issues in Burlington, he distracted his constituents by taking up these quixotic and socialist-bound foreign policy positions. And it pissed off Bernie to the point that he called the Times and said, I want to be interviewed about this. I have some comments to push back with. So this Sydney Ember interviewed Sanders, and it was published in the Sunday edition of the Times. And repeatedly, Sanders questions the questions that are being put forward, asserting that the reporter doesn't know what he or she is talking about. I think, Sydney, with all due respect, you don't understand a word that I'm saying. The follow-up question, do you believe you had an accurate view of President Ortega at the time? This wasn't about Ortega. Do you understand? I don't know if you do or not. Do you know that the United States overthrew the government of Chile way back? Do you happen to know that? Do you? I'm asking you a simple question. And in this exchange, the whole effort was to pin Bernie Sanders down as a supporter of socialist and nationalist rebellious regimes. They want to tag him as a socialist with a capital S. That's what the corporate media is trying to do, and there are Democrats who freely admit in Washington that they have their number one priority is to stop Bernie Sanders. And today, in a fresh in-depth interview with the acknowledged great thinker and activist and author, Francis Moore LePay, one of the things we talk about is the fear on the part of Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders of being tagged as socialist. And LePay, who lives in Massachusetts, wrote a gentle column addressed at Elizabeth Warren, questioning her statement, flatly saying, Warren, I'm a capitalist. And here's an excerpt from my conversation with Frankie Moore LePay, where we talk about Sanders and Warren and the fear of this socialist tag.
To most people, I'm a capitalist means that your sense of our economy and what works is limited to one approach, and that is means of production controlled by private individuals who, you know, profit from that capital investment. And it ignores the fact that a market economy that is thriving is what most people want. And it has many dimensions that are very effective today that are not owned by capital. And what I'm saying is that I've been so excited about the growth of the cooperative movement. And in many communities across the country, for example, public utilities are very effective, and they actually are can be more cost-efficient than privately held utilities. So there are many ways to organize a market economy that works for all of us and not dependent just on ownership by private capital, which leads to the extreme concentration of control that we have today, where in 12 industries, just two corporations control half or more of the market.
That's a comment from Francis Moore LePay. I'm releasing the full interview today to my subscribers at peterbcollins.com, at iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Spreaker. And we cover a lot of ground in the conversation. You won't be surprised that Frankie has a pretty inspiring message trying to restore democracy such as it is here in the United States. Now, speaking of Sanders, he's on a four-day trip across the South in the United States, and to his credit, he is not ducking the issue of abortion rights. After we've seen Louisiana and Alabama and Mississippi is next, and Missouri on Friday passed these very extreme and obviously unconstitutional bills. And what I'm seeing is that the Democratic candidates for president are championing abortion rights in this current climate because they're running in a Democratic primary. But we're hearing crickets, real radio silence from people like Nancy Pelosi and other national Democratic leaders who think that abortion is too hot to touch and that it costs them as many votes as it gains. That is an ugly political calculation, but I think that's what's going on. So Bernie Sanders said, look, this is not just a women's issue. This is an issue that impacts all of us, and the men must stand with the women in their moment of need. All right, guys, he asked the crowd, you in this struggle as well? And he repeated similar comments across four stops in the South on Saturday and Sunday. He said, look, it's not just a women's issue. It's obviously a woman that goes to get an abortion, but this is an issue that men cannot separate themselves from. Last I heard, it takes two to have a baby. I think men understand that, but I think that this is not just a women's issue. It's an issue that all of us have got to stand up and say that in America in 2019, you cannot take away a woman's right to control her own body. And I commend him for that position. Carl Howard, loyal, reliable listener in Columbus, Ohio, sent me a link this morning to a provocative commentary over at Counterpunch under the byline of Manuel Garcia Jr. And he says that the extremists on abortion who are gaining ground in the current climate, that this is not really a moral issue about whether abortion is right or wrong. It is about the fact that non-white groups are reproducing at a higher rate and that whites fear becoming a minority to a majority of racial minorities. And in one of the comments here, he says, American conservatives' opposition to abortion is not primarily concerned with preventing blacks, Latinos, minorities, and the poor from procreating too many non-white babies, but in fact to prevent white women from producing too few white babies. 60% of abortions annually in the United States are for white women. And he closes with this. While there is certainly a strong component of a war on women in anti-abortionism to cover for chauvinist male insecurity that seeks idiotic reassurance by possessing and dominating women, the deeper wellspring of American anti-abortionism is the white supremacist fear of demographic dilution. I think that's pretty interesting. I hope you'll think about it. And we had another episode with the grisly vote in Missouri on Friday. Another Republican put his foot in his mouth. This is State Rep. Barry Hovis, a former cop. And he said, you know, I've investigated a lot of sex crimes. Most of my rapes were not just the gentleman jumping out of the bushes that nobody had ever met. That was one or two times out of 100. Most of them were date rapes or consensual rapes. Now, this echoes the idiocy of Todd Akin, who ran for the Senate in Missouri after talking about legitimate rape. At least this guy Hovis got some feedback, and he did try to walk back his comments. He told AP he had misspoke, and that he meant to say date rapes or consensual or rape, and that he believes there's no such thing as consensual rape. So that brings us to Julian Assange and the announcement by Swedish prosecutors that they are beginning the process of asking a court to order the arrest of Julian Assange, and that would lead to an effort to extradite him from London. Now, it's unclear whether that would take precedence over the U.S. attempt to extradite Assange to the United States. And as you know, this is a touchy issue because I believe it's been used to smear Julian Assange and to create a pretext for his extradition, first to Sweden and then to the United States. And while I wasn't there, the public statements of the two women who did have consensual encounters with Assange, and they claim that in subsequent sex acts that he refused to wear a condom. Now, I don't condone that kind of behavior. But that is not rape. That is a dispute over how one is willing to have sex with a person in an encounter like this. And Swedish law is much tougher than American law. But I routinely hear him accused of rape, and that has never, never been a central feature of these allegations. Well, last week, San Francisco passed a measure banning the police department from using facial recognition software on its residents, and I support that. This week, the shareholders of Amazon are meeting in Seattle on Wednesday, and there are two shareholder resolutions. One would prohibit sales of the facial recognition system that Amazon calls Recognition, with a K, not a C. Prohibit sales to government agencies unless the board concludes that the technology does not facilitate human rights violations. The other resolution, both of these are non-binding, asks the company to commission an independent report examining the extent to which recognition may threaten civil, human, and privacy rights. But we're seeing a wave now. Across the bay, Oakland, California is considering a similar ban. Also, Somerville, Massachusetts, outside Boston. And state lawmakers in California and Massachusetts are introducing bills to restrict the use of facial recognition software. And this is an area where we don't have adequate regulation. The technology has grown faster than any regulatory structure. And there's kind of a parallel to what happened after the Patriot Act was passed after 9/11. And it included the power of the FBI to issue these self-written warrants called national security letters. This is an abuse that I have been railing about since Mueller was the FBI director and then when Comey was the FBI director. We know that these are widely abused. And what's really onerous is that they often come with a gag order. So that if you're a company that's served with a national security letter, you can't tell, for example, you run a server business, you can't notify Peter B. Collins or Counterpunch or whatever that they have been the target of a national security letter. Well, to his credit, a federal judge here in San Francisco named Vince Chhabra, or Chhabria, he is challenging the FBI, which is resisting dropping the gag orders on these dated, stale national security letters. He says these are particular investigations for which the FBI has determined it is not a problem to lift the non-disclosure requirement. That's the gag order. There's no reason to expect that company usage patterns for that unique subset of people would reflect the company usage patterns for everyone being investigated, and that under a 2015 law, the FBI is supposed to wait 3 years after issuing an individual gag order before considering whether to lift it. The judge said it's hard to understand how requiring the government to turn over this seemingly stale and harmless information would constitute disclosure of a law enforcement technique or procedure. Right on, Your Honor. The NSLs should never have been authorized, and this is a huge, huge challenge to our Fourth and Fifth Amendment rights, and I hope the judge will continue to push back on the FBI. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it everywhere. You'll find it on YouTube, and I'm still Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.